Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo, Aaron Alvarado, and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Aaron Alvarado in Los Angeles, how you doing?
That's me. I'm feeling great. How you doing, David?
Good. Still wearing the Dodgers hat, I see.
I will never give up on the Dodgers.
Good.
Unless they lose in the World Series again next year, then I'm done with them. I can't do it anymore. It's too heartbreaking.
Well, you're wearing a Dodgers hat. I'm certainly wearing my Kings hat. Not just the hat, but the shirt. Sacramento basketball. Because, our teams finally played each other.
They did.
We had our rookies that faced off against each other. And I'm not talking about Lonzo Ball and De'Aaron Fox. I'm talking about Kyle Kuzma and Bogdan Bogdanovic.
The battle of the awesomely hyped rookies.
So the Lakers came in town to Sacramento, which is always interesting because it's a sellout game. And we upgraded our season tickets for this game. So I got pretty decently close to the court. I just wanted to be in, you know, an ear distance of Lonzo Ball, which thankfully I was. So I got to, you know, share just some goodwill, you know, positive messages with him, which was really great. I wanted to welcome Lonzo to Sacramento and
sure.
Congratulate him on getting his brother out of China.
Was LeVar there by any chance? Was his dad in the audience?
I really did look. I mean, there's a section where generally like the visitor families are, and I was scanning for LeVar. But
if LeVar's there, you got to shake his hand, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, yes. He owned Donald Trump. He owned the president. That doesn't happen. That rarely happens. To a sitting president, and LeVar absolutely owned him. So, on you, LeVar.
Well, that's the thing is, like, the game was the same day that the president had replied once again to LeVar Ball about how he should have left his son in China, which is pretty incredible.
Did you see? So apparently this news story came out that apparently it's very common for American tourists to shoplift in China, and there isn't a big penalty, and it's actually usually just a fine, and they're kicked out of the country.
Is that right?
So that's what I read. I don't know. I don't know. Wow. I've never done it. So, but apparently, like it's pretty normal for people to shoplift in China, for Americans at least.
I'm gonna be in China in a couple weeks. I have a layover for about 3 hours on my way to Tokyo.
Oh, wow.
In Xiamen, China.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want me to find out, I can.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Can you live stream it?
Yeah, I could do it. I don't play for UCLA, so I don't know if it'll get a ton of publicity. But my dad will definitely hate to the president on my behalf.
Can we get the Brave Little Podcast banned in China?
Yes.
Can we get them added? Get them to add our podcast to the Great Filter or whatever they call it,
That's right, Great Wall Filter.
Yeah.
Along with Facebook.
Oh yeah, exactly. And Google.
Well, this is on Facebook Live right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing I don't know if they have access to Apple iTunes for podcasts or not.
Oh, they use Stitcher over there.
So. Oh, they're just Stitcher only. Okay,
Stitcher only.
Stitcher. Anyway, back to the game. Just I know we're not a sports podcast, but there's not a lot of chances for people from Sacramento to gloat towards those in Los Angeles. Sure enough, we beat the Los Angeles Lakers pretty handily. A lot of, you know, beat LA chance. Our seats were behind the free throw where you have the little like inflatable tube things that you hit, you know, to mm-hmm. try to distract from the free throws.
Right.
And they have this thing at Golden 1 Center in Sacramento where if an opponent misses two consecutive free throws, everyone in the arena gets a free jumbo jack from Jack in the Box. And Lonzo Ball missed two free throws, and it was the loudest that arena's been all year. People were like just so psyched that A, they were getting jumbo jacks for free, and B, it was Lonzo that missed them, and it was just like, it was perfect.
So what's the tie-in there? Is it the fact that when you eat a jumbo jack, it feels like you have a brick in your stomach? So is that what that is? I don't understand the tie-in.
No, yeah.
Whatever.
It's definitely a stretch. I don't think there's any close tie-in.
Yeah, no, he had a rough night. I'll admit that. Lonzo had a rough night.
Not great.
And Kuzma didn't shoot very well either. I mean, in general, the Lakers aren't a good shooting team.
Yeah.
So you guys, you earned that one. But wait till we meet again in L.A. We're going to get our revenge.
Well, and that's going to be in February? No, sooner than that.
I think it's January.
Yeah, in February you're coming back to Sacramento again.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting is because we had seats that were upgraded and we were close to the court, there were some gentlemen that were heckling the Laker players quite a bit. And I was surprised at the amount Kuzma was getting heckled, and a lot of it had to do with just going back to Utah. You know, Kuzma's from like Flint, Michigan, I believe. But yeah, he played basketball at the University of Utah, and they were heckling him for playing basketball at the University of Utah. And I was like, you know what? This is heckling I can get behind. I can get behind heckling towards players that played for the University of Utah. I was like proud of my fellow Sacramentans. It's coming up with some pretty clever Utah heckles.
Obviously those heckles work because he had an off shooting night.
He did not have a great game, but you know what? De'Aaron Fox didn't have a terrific game either. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he scored 12 or 13 points, but Bogdan Bogdanovic was our rookie that really kind of shined. And same with Frank Mason. But anyway, it wasn't an exciting game, mostly just because the Kings were winning the whole time. And so I, as grateful as I am to have won the game, it is more fun when it's close, you know.
So it is. It totally is. I actually couldn't watch that game. I was at the LA Kings game at the time, so I had to follow along on my my scoreboard app.
Yeah.
But was that the game where you caught the T-shirt?
No, that was the Clippers game.
Okay.
Which was last night. Speaking of LA teams, we lost that one by 2 points, which was a bummer.
Rough.
Hey, look. The last four home games before that, we had won. Four home games that I had been to, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
We had won. And that was against OKC, Philly, Portland, and then the Lakers.
Well, I think you got that Laker win now. It's just going to be all losses from here on out.
Yeah, so. It certainly is going to be on the road. Our overall record is not good.
But what was on that T-shirt that you caught?
It says Sacramento Proud.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the back, it was just a giant number one that's gold. Just a golden one. After the Golden One Credit Union, which is the namesake of the new arena.
Of course. So, why aren't you wearing that shirt right now?
Because it's an XXXXL. dude, look, I've made it on the Jumbotron a couple times already. I'm really proud of it. I mean, I've not just caught T-shirts at this game. I've been on the Jumbotron.
You're a fixture.
I got to carry the game ball down to the court one of the games.
Wow.
Against Houston, the home opener. Pretty excited.
Very cool, yeah.
I was on the Jumbotron for that. Also, I had a pop quiz question where they asked if I could pronounce the name of one of our players, who was Scal Labissiere. And, of course, I know how to pronounce Haitian names perfectly. And so that was
a huge
speak,
win. You speak French, so.
Well, yeah.
They didn't know that. They didn't count
Haitian
on that.
French.
Right. And the one that you haven't mentioned was you were on the Kiss Cam with your dad.
Oh, so, yeah. We that's pretty cool. Awkward, like, no, Kiss Cam.
Well, he's like, you were down for it, but he's a little less progressive than you. So he said no.
Yeah. Anyway, enough gloating from me. You've already lost a World Series. I don't need to gloat about how you guys lost.
Yes, thank you.
Among the worst teams in the NBA. So. Anyway, we do have some movies to get to. I did want to mention one quick topic, non-movie related, kind of movie related, because The Last Jedi comes out next month. But you're a gamer. You like to play video games. Do you play Star Wars Battlefront? This has been in the news.
I did play Battlefront, and then I hear the second one just came out, right?
Yes. And it had a tremendous amount of bad publicity around what's called microtransactions. Essentially, in the gaming community, just to give some context, this is it's kind of been building this anger around this model, this monetization model that a lot of games will do, which they'll charge full price for a game, which is like $60 nowadays. And then inside the game, they'll have different either maps, levels, abilities that you can buy that are called microtransactions. Now, some games will do it where the things that you can purchase in-game, and this is just like anyone that has an iPhone or any smartphone understands in-app purchases, you know, the model of downloading something for free, and then, you know, you get to a point where you need to purchase things inside the game. The problem is this is not downloading a game for free. It's purchasing it for $60, and then you have things inside that you have to, you know, purchase really to progress. Now, a lot of games have done it where the things that you can purchase in-game are not critical to progression, right? So you can still buy for $60, never pay a dime in microtransaction fees, and get along just fine. Except this new Star Wars game, Battlefront, made the progression system like next to impossible. It wasn't even skill based. Like you had to log dozens and dozens and dozens of hours in order to progress your character, or you can purchase these loot crates where you can't, you're not even guaranteed what you're going to get. And it was like really expensive. Jeez. Like you could spend hundreds of dollars and not get necessarily what you want because it's like randomized. And so essentially the gaming community just rioted. And to the point that it was all over Reddit, it was all over the news, people were boycotting it, and Bob Iger, this is, you know, chairman of Disney, had to step in to EA Games and be like, what's going on? You're tarnishing the Star Wars brand, knock it off. So they pulled the microtransactions from the game entirely, and they said they'll bring them back at some point, but not now, which honestly is just a matter of, like, they're waiting till The Last Jedi comes out so they don't have the swarm of bad publicity, and then they'll bring back the microtransactions. Anyway, the sad news is the game itself, like the campaign I've been playing, and it's like super fun and super interesting. And I've been loving it, but in the actual multiplayer, once they bring back those microtransactions, it's just going to be a swarm of angry gamers again.
Of course. And so that's the thing. Like if you're a kid and or if you're a parent and you buy this game for your kid, now you shelled out the $65 for the original game, and now your kid is asking you for another $30 or $40, $50 to get the rest of the game. So you're now spending $120 on this one game just so they can play, just so it can be fun, essentially. So I totally sympathize with anyone that's complaining about this. It's a total ripoff, and I will not be buying this game, I don't think. But, you know, I said the same thing about the Call of Duty, and I ended up getting that one for free. The last Call of Duty. Awesome. It's a great game, though. Well, it's really fun.
I want to boycott. Like, I wanted to believe that I had the courage to cancel my pre-order of Battlefront 2. And there was about, like, maybe 5 or 10 minutes that I truly believed I possessed the courage to cancel. And it turns out I did not. I actually did not possess that courage.
So are there any spoilers in this game? I think there was a spoiler in the last game, if I recall.
So they're for the, like, Last Jedi spoilers?
There are
a few allusions to certain plot points, and specifically an object that Luke Skywalker actually carries with him.
Is it a puffin?
No, it's not one of the ports that you see.
Okay.
Delightful creatures, by the way. Can't wait to see how them and Chewbacca interact. There is this object. I won't, because it might be considered a spoiler, I won't say exactly what it is. But
is it a lightsaber?
There is a side mission that deals with him retrieving this artifact.
Oh, okay.
And we can see in the trailers that he has it on his person. And so we'll see how that actually plays. So it's not a spoiler, but it gives you a little bit of context for what it is in the movie, and it makes me look forward to seeing what significance it plays.
Right. It's interesting that the chairman of Disney had to step in and say, back off. That's insane.
Yeah. Bob Iger had to be like, I don't know what's going on. I've never heard of microtransactions in my life.
Right. He's like, what are you guys doing? You know, we have the biggest movie in our franchise coming out in less than a month, right?
And EA has an exclusivity deal, right, to do this. And, you know, Bob is just like, we're going to yank this, right? Like, this is...
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
And so he applied the pressure. But, like, this is the sad thing, and this is why gamers get so upset, is the model works. They make so much more money. Just because there's little kids that are doing it and the parents don't know any better, they just, you know, they give them... They allow them to play. You know, and so if it's a model that works and makes money, you know, they're going to keep doing it.
They're never going to stop. Yeah. So, just to show how massive Disney is, EA Sports brings in almost $5 billion in revenue every year. But all it took was one phone call from the head of Disney to get them to change their mind. It's incredible, really.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Very, very, very powerful company and very powerful case of Bob Iger.
Right.
Anyway, I wanted to touch on that just because it had been so... I mean, one last point on that. Because the progression system now... There may not be microtransactions, but the progression system is still very, very flawed because it's not skill-based, meaning you could play a match on multiplayer, and if you had the most kills, you'd get the most points to progress to the next level.
Sure.
It's no longer based on how good you play. It's just straight-up hours. And so the multiplayer rounds are getting ruined because players are doing what's called rubber banding, And what they're doing is they're taking these rubber bands and they are attaching them to the to the joysticks on their PlayStation or Xbox controllers around and just essentially starting a game and leaving. And as long as your player is moving, you won't get kicked out for inactivity. And so, and they'll have like they'll rubber band the joysticks, and they'll have some like robot thing that's just doing a constant, you know, on the A button. And so a match will end, and they'll enter into the next one, and then the rubber bands keep it so they're always moving, and they'll go to work. They'll leave the thing going for 12 hours, and they'll get back, and they'll have, you know, all the points that they would have gotten for just, you know, hours played. And that's so, so you funny. Get you jump into these multiplayer matches, and there's these guys that are just like running in circles.
Gosh, what a waste. So it's funny. I have a little anecdote about something like that. Right when I got out of high school, I went to a technical college, and the technical college had a huge computer lab, probably 100 computers, and some of the students were running this. It was a permanent banner that sat on your desktop, and it paid you to watch ads while you were online. So what they did is they installed this banner on every single one of the computers, and they ran a script that moved the mouse that kept the banner active. So the banner, if you stopped moving the mouse, the banner would turn off and you wouldn't earn any money. So the script they were running would move the mouse gently across the screen, and these guys were racking up money just by installing this program on all these computers. So I got in on it, but I only made like $10. So
still $10.
It was a total pyramid scheme. It was pretty interesting. Wow. They don't do that anymore. But
you got a free lunch out of it.
I sure did. Yeah, totally worth it. That's the only good thing I got out of that school. So
Ooh. Student loans.
Oh yeah, exactly. A lot of student loans.
Well, all right. We have a couple movies to talk about. The interesting thing here is that these two movies we're going to talk about are pretty diametrically, I mean, they're on the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, you know, cinema fare. One being lighthearted and one a little bit more, based in reality because it's a documentary. But I wanted to start with the lighter fare, a movie that I have been a big advocate for, and it's been released digitally recently, and you saw, and it's called Brigsby Bear. Brigsby Bear is available on iTunes right now to rent or buy. This is a film that is written by and starring Kyle Mooney, who is famous for being in Saturday Night Live. And it's directed and co-written by a couple of his friends, kind of childhood friends that started a YouTube channel called Good Neighbor. It also... You know, that includes Beck Bennett from Saturday Night Live, the guy who plays Vladimir Putin, and he plays Mike Pence in SNL. And so these are familiar faces, people that most people are going to have recognized, at least from SNL. But this film isn't necessarily a comedy. When the first trailer dropped, it didn't really reveal too much about what the plot was, but it was enough to have me intrigued. However, you were a little bit more skeptical. What'd you think of that first trailer?
Yeah, so the first trailer, it's pretty ambiguous. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, I am not an SNL fan whatsoever. So I'm not a Kyle Mooney fan. I have no connection to any of that stuff that they do. So seeing this trailer, it just, it looked a little too cutesy. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't delve into the plot whatsoever, other than the fact like, it looks very like a very whimsical movie. That's the whole kind of the whole feel of the very first trailer. I don't know if you want to kind of explain what happens in the movie, because they do. If you watch the second trailer, it tells you a whole lot.
Yeah,
I
don't think it's too much of a spoiler. I do think we should go into it. We can't really talk about it otherwise.
Yeah.
But I guess the basic gist of the premise is you have this main character who's like a 30-year-old male played by Kyle Mooney. Who is in the underground bunker, who believes he can't go outside because like the air is poison. And his parents, or who he believes are his parents, we come to find out are people that had kidnapped him when he was a baby and have held him in this underground bunker ever since. It's actually his father's played by Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker. And the woman that plays his mother, the actress will have to forgive me because I don't immediately recall her name.
Her name is Jane Addams.
Jane Addams, yeah. She's very recognizable. But it was amazing that they were able to get both Mark Hamill and Jane Addams to play these parts, which is incredible. But
very small parts, but
basically,
very important.
He's being indoctrinated into this very specific religious dogma that is mostly unfamiliar. It doesn't follow any like tenets of any religion that you're familiar with, but it follows kind of the similar beats to religion generally. And he's raised being indoctrinated through this show called Brigsby Bear that he mm-hmm. thinks the whole world is watching. But it turns out that the show is really only produced for him by his you know, pseudo father, Mark Hamill, who creates this whole production that looks very, very retro 80s VHS. I mean, they're all on VHS. And it's just like hundreds of episodes, dozens of seasons. And he thinks that this is like a major TV show. Well, you know, towards the very beginning of the film, he ends up getting freed from this, you know, situation that he's in. And he gets introduced to the real world and his real parents. And so a lot of this story is somewhat of a fish out of water type story where he's trying to kind of realize the world around him. But the only thing he really wants is to watch the next episode of Brigsby Bear. And when he realizes that this wasn't a show everyone is watching, that it was being produced by his, you know, who he believed was his father, he takes it upon himself to create the final Brigsby Bear episode in the form of a movie. And so that's the premise of the film.
Yeah, and again, you don't really see that in the first trailer. So when, you know, watching that first trailer, I was pretty skeptical. I didn't care for the cast, and the story seemed a little too far out there. But going into the movie and just kind of letting go and just experiencing all this stuff that you talked about, it happens in the first 15 minutes. So it's not really a spoiler. It happens right away. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the journey for this movie. Once he gets out, like you said, it's a fish out of the water story. He's about 30 years old, and he's hanging out with these high school kids. It's his new sister, their friends, and it's all about his first experiences, you know, his first kiss, his first party, his first beer. It's so that's part of the whole fun. But like one of the biggest element of the movie is really, like you said, creating this movie for himself. So he learns the whole process of making a production, and he shoots this Brigsby Bear movie with his new friends, and they go on this adventure of trying to create this final episode. And he learns how to storyboard, he learns how to write, he learns how to direct. And so that's what this movie plays to. If you have any sort of creativity or any sort of interest in filmmaking or television production, you're gonna love this movie. Yeah. It speaks to you, and it spoke to me, like the creative part of that sits inside of me, and it inspired me, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
This movie is so much fun. I ended up loving it, and I didn't expect to like it whatsoever. So I will say good on Kyle Mooney.
Yeah.
And Mark Hamill is great in this. He has a small part,
yes,
but he's so, so good.
He's really good in his small
yeah.
part. It's really
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
It's one of those films that I feel really comfortable recommending. And like I said, mm-hmm. it's not streaming anywhere, at least not yet, but it is available to rent on iTunes. It's worth the $3.99 or whatever it is.
It's absolutely. I think it's $6, and it's absolutely okay. worth the money.
Yeah.
You will have a good time watching this. You're going to be entertained. Like you said, it's not a pure comedy, but there are very funny moments in this movie.
Yes. Greg Kinnear is part of several of them.
Oh,
he's great.
Yeah, Greg Kinnear, he plays the lead detective,
yeah.
and who also has a side job as a Shakespearean actor,
yeah.
A community theater, and he gets involved in the whole production. And it's really, really funny. The movie has a ton of heart.
I think that's the one
thing that stands out to me is just how much heart this has. Great writing, great characters, great performances. I loved it. I can't wait to watch it again. I had so much fun watching it. So
yeah. Yeah.
I totally recommend it.
Absolutely. I feel very confident that anyone watching or listening to this, you know, check it out. You're not gonna walk away hating that film. It's gonna at least inspire you. But I'm pretty confident you're gonna love it. Yeah.
Has my question, Kyle Mooney, what else has he done film wise? Is he just like strictly SNL and online stuff?
I got to know him through his YouTube channel first, and then he got picked mm-hmm. up by SNL. And so most people okay. are gonna know him from one or the other. And they do like, you know, live shows, the Good Neighbor, you know, YouTube group.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, he's been in some side, like Zoolander 2, he had a side role. And like, mm-hmm. you know, some of these ensemble, you know, groups of like SNL actors, like he'll have like a small bit part. But this is his first major, it's like starring gig. And
he carries the movie. He's
absolutely.
Really great yeah. in the role of James.
No, he does. I mean, really, he does
excellent.
The proper amount of like naive, you mm-hmm. know, trying to adapt, like super awkward and underdeveloped.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, he's really good.
And he runs the gamut of emotions. Like, you feel sorry for him. You dislike him at points.
Yeah.
He's a jerk sometimes. And he's really funny sometimes. Man, I just can't. I was just so surprised at how much I like this movie.
Yeah.
I think you'll be too if you don't have any expectations going into this, or even if you're skeptical like I was. I think you're going to be surprised at how great this little movie is.
And those listening, if you're familiar with the state of Utah or anything in Utah, it was filmed entirely in Utah.
Oh, there you go.
You'll definitely recognize the Wasatch Front backdrop, those mountains. The party he goes to is in Cedar Hills, Utah. That will be funny to people who know Utah. You see all sorts of, you know, there's different, you know, iconic Utah things like Intermountain Healthcare he has to go to and yada, yada, yada. And it embraces the fact that it's in Utah. And so I think that'll be a pleasant surprise for the people that are familiar with the Beehive State. So that's Brigsby Bear. Rent it, buy it if you want to support good movies.
Yeah.
And it's a good, it's lighthearted. It's a film that you would think tonally would be very difficult to pull off, yet it's pulled off here. It could have gone dark and in a direction that would have been very different, but they didn't. They definitely went for...
It just has just the right amount of edge to it.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too.
Because you could totally fall into the cutesy...
And it didn't do that.
And it doesn't. Mm-mm.
Yeah,
it does not.
Yeah. Also, shout out to Andy Samberg, who has a little cameo in here. Yeah.
Did we really need Andy Samberg?
No,
in that
he
part?
Didn't. But The Lonely Island was their producers of this film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I see.
Yeah. So Very good. So check out Brigsby Bear. Now the other film we want to talk about is something that I know I was excited when I first saw the trailer for. You had shared the trailer, a while ago. I feel like almost a year ago.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
But it's available now on Amazon Prime. And so if you have an Amazon Prime subscription, which if you're listening to this, you do, because the whole world does, this is free to watch and stream from Amazon Prime Video. And it's a film directed by Matthew Heineman called City of Ghosts.
The men and women of Raqqa is being slaughtered silently are real journalistic heroes. They work in secret and under constant threat, reporting on the depredations of ISIS in their home city. Some have fled in fear for their own lives. Even in exile, they are in no way safe.
It's not enough to expose the crimes of ISIS. We must also fight against their ideology.
Either we will win, or they will kill all of us.
So City of Ghosts is a documentary that follows the efforts of a group of citizen activist journalists calling themselves Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. And this is a group of people that they're citizens of the city of Raqqa in Syria. Their city was liberated from the Assad regime. It was an oppressive regime, and so they took control from Assad's military. And once the military was driven out, ISIS crept in, and they filled that power vacuum. And once ISIS took over, they basically closed the borders of the city. They didn't let anyone leave. They controlled every aspect of the city, from the way the people dressed, the way that there was no media anywhere whatsoever. The only media that was released was propaganda created by ISIS. So the world had no idea what was happening in this major Syrian city. And what was going on was, you know, ISIS is obviously a brutal form of Islam, and they had free rein to do whatever they wanted. So if you question them, if you even stop for a second and didn't completely give yourself over to ISIS control, they would kill you in the streets, essentially. So this documentary is very, very brutal. It's very graphic. There's scenes that are they pull no punches. All right, so they be prepared to see some grisly imagery. And I've actually heard the director, Matthew Heineman, talk about it, and he said, if we didn't show those scenes, I feel like we would be cheating the story, because this is what really happened in this city.
Yeah.
People were being beheaded. People were being massacred in the streets just for being accused of not cooperating with ISIS. So that's what this story is. Basically, it follows a small group of these journalist activists who took it upon themselves to upload videos and post images of what was really going on in the streets of Raqqa. And so, of course, anytime that they posted this stuff, ISIS was upset. The leaders of ISIS were upset, and they would chase these guys down. They would murder their family members. Mm-hmm. They did their best to try to silence these dissenters. And so this is the group that's being showcased in this documentary. And it's all about their lives, their stories, how they came to be these journalists. Most of them had zero interest in journalism. One guy was like a math teacher. He was a math teacher. Another guy was just, he had an interest in documentary filmmaking. Nothing political. Like this is the key. So none of these guys had any sort of political aspirations whatsoever. But they were thrust into this position because their city was overrun.
Yeah.
So they felt like they had a duty to showcase to the world what was happening to their friends and their family members and to the city that they loved. And that's what this story. That's the story that's being told in this documentary. So you get to meet these interesting people. You get to hear just a piece of their story and their struggle, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's heartbreaking too to see what they've gone through and the sacrifices that they're willing to make. To make their story known. So
it is such compelling documentary cinema, and I would encourage people to see it, not just because it's difficult to watch and you have to see it, but I do think it's a story that's both fascinating, yes, heartbreaking, but also like I think that there's a lot of hope to be seen here too, because you're seeing these people, like Aaron was saying, this is math teachers, just regular people that are in the mm-hmm. situation where, you know, they what started with a revolution against the Assad regime quickly turns into, as you said, this power vacuum that ISIS fills. And they realize like, oh, our city, we're now prisoner to this, you know, extremist group that is doing these public executions. What are we going to do about it? And it's just what almost feels like the most unlikely group of people, really the only group of people that felt like, you know, if we don't do this, no one will.
Exactly. And that's the thing. They had to take it upon themselves because no one was going to save them. They had no other alternatives.
Yeah. They really didn't.
So.
And it's incredible to watch because it gives you some context of what's going on, at least in that part of the Middle East. Like, I had heard of Raqqa, knowing that you know, I knew it was a city in Syria. I knew that it was like the ISIS capital and stronghold. I really didn't know what it was like for some of the everyday citizens that were there before ISIS had taken over Raqqa. But to see these people fighting from within the city, and eventually, you know, in the documentary, you're following some of these main individuals that founded the group. That's like RBSS, which is, you know, Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, which, side note, terrific branding, terrific name for a group. They don't get cutesy. They call it like it is. The group
right.
is called Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, which is exactly what's been happening. And so as soon as you hear that's what their group is, what they're bringing awareness to, you know, it doesn't need any explanation. Like, it's all these atrocities are happening, and it's happening silently because, as you see in the documentary, ISIS has everyone destroy satellite dishes. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, all media comms, everything comes down. ISIS sends out their own videos and propaganda to show, you know, that, oh, it's a paradise in Raqqa, you know, that ISIS is... You know, that like everything is going well in the city, that, you know, they're, you know,
that the people want to be
yes,
there.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah, the people yeah. love having them there. You know, it shows that their whole principles and their whole ideology is good and it's bearing fruit, mm-hmm. which it wasn't. I mean, there were people in lines to get food. People were dying, not just from execution, but, you know, people couldn't get food. I mean, it was a terrible situation. And so the main characters we follow eventually have to get out of Raqqa. They go to these safe houses in Germany and in Turkey. And even in Turkey, they end up not being really that safe because it's right there in the right. Syrian border. But you're following these people. And what the documentary is so good at doing is that it doesn't just shock you with the images of what ISIS is doing, though there are video clips and things. But it also gives a peek into these people's lives where they talk about, what their hopes and dreams are. Like, they didn't want to do this. They didn't want to be citizen journalists and activists. They didn't want to be political in this way. You know, like I said, like, there was a math teacher there. There were people who wanted to get into filmmaking and yada, yada. And so, you see them talk about, like, one of them talks about how he hopes to get married someday. Well, you know, they talk about, like, hopefully they you know, they'll have a city to go back to. And they have this realization as the documentary goes on that maybe they, Rocco won't, there won't ever really be a home to go back to. It'll never be the same.
Right.
And that's, like, the sad reality of what happened in Raqqa. And, of course, you know, the events are still unfolding. The city has been, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, you know, liberated from ISIS now. But still, it's a situation that, you know, bears monitoring.
Oh, for sure. And I think one of the main points of the documentary is they touch on this a couple times, where they say that the battle cannot be won with guns. You're never going to win with
bombs, yeah.
With guns or bombs. You have to win the battle of ideas. And so that's at the core of what they're fighting for. And that's the reason that they're putting their lives on the line.
Yeah.
And I think that that's great that you bring up hope, because you do see glimmers of hope. I'm thinking of one of the scenes where some of them get out and they go to Germany. And it's like you see smiles on their faces for the first time in the entirety of the documentary. You see these people smiling and laughing, having a snowball fight. I mean, it's, you see the human spirit come out in them.
Yeah.
And the way that they contrast their hope in Germany with the feelings of the native Germans, the far right.
Yeah.
It's again, absolutely heartbreaking to see the reaction of these nationalists is what they are, really. They're German nationalists. Their protests of all refugees is just heartbreaking.
It is. So. The two most heartbreaking components of this film, the really two most heartbreaking for me, was one, a sequence in which they show that once they're identified who they are, this group of, you know, the Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, that their families are going after, their father's killed in this video, that they watch over and over again as oddly a source of strength and reminder about what they're fighting for. Mm-hmm. And their resolve, like their response to their friends, family members that are being killed in video, and ISIS saying, "We're coming after you if you don't stop. We're killing your family members. If you don't stop, like, we'll find you and we'll kill you." And they keep going. It was both heartbreaking, but also that was part of, like, the strength of that, seeing, like, that, you know, and their attitude in the interviews about, like, we knew that this was a possibility. We knew the risks of doing this. And we're not, you know, this is bigger than just us or our families. This is for an entire city, our entire home. And, like, seeing that, right, was heartbreaking, but in turn inspiring. But then the part that you just mentioned is you see this struggle for them to get out of that city and to fight for the people in there. And you see in the documentary, you're about an hour in, you know, you have a pretty good sense for how bad things are and how grateful you are to, like, you know, the German government for taking in, you know, these citizen journalists and what they're doing. And then all of a sudden, boom, you see these protests of these nationalist Germans saying they don't want to take in any refugees, which means the people that you were just watching, you know, these German nationalists don't want anything to do with them being there or what they're doing. And you realize how terrible it is to turn away refugees, especially in this case, because, you know, these are refugees that had a cause, that were fighting for something good and something right.
Right.
And that these people are just like, we don't want anything to do with them. And that's, you know, not to get super political, but that's the reality of also what's happening in our country, in the way we, you know, certain people view and think of refugees. They think of refugees as if they're the ones that are ISIS. And we have to realize that, no, they're the people fleeing that very thing. They're that type of extremism. And that, you know, we should absolutely be the country that opens our arms and welcomes those people in. And this documentary, it's not, the purpose of the documentary is not to convince people of that, but it is a quick side note and to show, you know, the reality of that situation. It gives good context to it, which I really appreciated.
Yeah. I mean, you go to appreciate the fact that these people, I mean, they have no home. Even their temporary home, they're not wanted there. So there's just no rest for them. And you see, like, there's one extremely powerful scene where you see a member of this group who very obviously has PTSD. I mean, he's bringing up some old memories and he's literally shaking. He cannot stop from shaking as he's showing these old photos of his dead friends. Again, it's gut wrenching.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the fact that this documentary is made, because I had no idea that this stuff was, I knew that there's turmoil there and these people were, being savagely slaughtered, but this puts a real face on it for me as someone, you know, just a dumb American who lives a privileged lifestyle, like to see that these people, this is how they live in it, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
And something's got
to
change.
And that whole, like, you know, you refer to yourself as a dumb American. There was this interesting scene that it opens up the film with it, and then it comes back to it towards the end, where these citizen journalists are receiving a reward or an award from this is in New York City, but it was some media award for what they were doing. And then the conversations they were having with, like, kind of the other American media groups, it was funny because, you know, the media groups that they were speaking to from America were saying, like, oh, good job what you guys are doing. You know, it's really important work. Like, good job, you know. And they were saying generally encouraging things. But after having watched the lion's share of the documentary, you realize how clueless the people in this room are. They have no idea what's actually happening and what those people have been through. You know, and while, you know, it's better that they're embracing them and shining a light on them than not, it really is the juxtaposition of having seen from the documentary perspective as a viewer to knowing that, you know, these people have not any idea what they've gone through is pretty jarring.
It's really, really eye-opening. I think that there's a tendency for people, for Americans, to feel like we're living in some sort of battleground. I guess, like, you know, obviously we've had terrorist attacks in this country, but to act like this is some sort of active battleground for terrorism is insane when you see what's really happening across the world, especially in the Middle East, obviously, where we're talking literal battlegrounds. It's just really, the perspective is sorely needed, and I think that we all need to take a look and see, just take a minute, you know, an hour and a half out of your life and watch this movie. Because it's so important. This is a real, these are real stories of real individuals, real human beings. I think that's the key to it. This is one of the reasons that I love documentary filmmaking so much. Like, these are real stories. Just of average everyday people that have just, they've risen to the occasion, and this is shining a light on them. And I got to hand it to Matthew Heineman. He's turning into one of the best documentary filmmakers working today. So,
well, you know, watching it, I couldn't help but think about the type of footage that he had. Granted, a lot of it was footage, you know, that he had to get from the individuals in Raqqa, from their cell phones and what they had taken. Of course, he couldn't be there to film it. For obvious reasons, I'm assuming this all started after ISIS had taken hold of the city in terms of the documentary.
So I actually looked into this. All the stuff in Syria that was smuggled out, any video shot outside of Syria, he shot it himself.
So in Turkey and in Berlin.
He was in Turkey. Yeah, he was in Turkey and he was in Germany.
So yeah, I figured the Syria stuff couldn't have been him, but everything else was him.
No, and he actually joked about that in the one interview I saw. He said, you know, I wanted to shoot in Syria, but I would have been murdered, and I'd prefer not to be murdered. So I would have been shot on sight.
Well, what I was going to say, though, even with that footage, I think he showed a tremendous amount of patience, because I think there are some shocking scenes in this film that I think, like, most filmmakers, especially documentary filmmakers, would have tried to quickly get to some sort of resolve or ending so they could release what they had. But you could tell he waited long enough to have enough footage to tell a more full story and in turn a more effective story. When I think a lot of people would have released some version of that way earlier than he did. And I'm so grateful that he didn't, because when you get the kind of the longevity, especially the stuff that's going on in Turkey and in Germany, you get more full context and a much better story for it. And so to have that patience when you know you're sitting on, like, some really compelling footage, it shows the sign of someone that's not just a documentary filmmaker, but someone who's interested in telling the right story. So I think he did incredible work here.
And we've talked about most previous work, the movie Cartel Land, which is currently streaming on Netflix.
Yep.
I think we're both really big fans of that one. So to see his follow-up is just really impressive. And you can see how he's growing as a filmmaker.
Absolutely.
And I can't wait to see what he does next.
Yeah. So this documentary, again, City of Ghosts, it's on Amazon Prime for free to stream. So if you have an Amazon Prime account, a lot of people don't realize this, that have Amazon Prime, that you have access to free video. Terry Hermanson is asking again, City of Ghosts, if you're still listening, The name of the documentary, City of Ghosts. So again, if you have an Amazon Prime account, you can view this for free with Amazon Prime Video. Again, there's grisly images and video because it includes the ISIS videos. So not for the faint of heart in that regard, but I do still think it's worth watching, even if you feel like, you know, that type of content is too hard to stomach. You can close your eyes, you can look away, but I do think...
A lot of people have said that they had to look away. They had to look away during some of the scenes because it's too real. It's too raw.
Yeah.
So.
So anyway, it's for free if you have Amazon Prime, which probably most of the people listening, please check it out. City of Ghosts. Incredible.
If you don't have Prime, just hit me up. You can borrow my login. I'll let you borrow.
Seriously. Message just either one
don't
of us.
Order we'll anything. Login. Please don't order anything. Please, whatever you do. Can I just bring up real quick?
Yeah.
They don't just show the ISIS like executing people. They also show the ISIS recruiting videos.
Yeah, their tactics.
Which are... It's absolutely insane to see that the amount of production that goes into their recruiting videos.
Well, yeah. In one of the clips for their recruiting videos, they make it look like a first-person shooter video game, where it shows the view of, you know, behind the gun, you know, anyone that's played a video first-person shooter video game, and how they're fighting off infidels. And then it zooms back out, and it follows the individual like it's a video game. And they know their target.
Straight out of a video game. Yeah.
It's
no doubt about it. The special effects they use, it looks like a Michael Bay film. Wild, man. Really, really crazy. And they show that they recruited people that have
media
production
skills.
Experience. Yeah. Yeah, media skills. So really, really interesting stuff.
So anyway, thank you for both introducing me to the trailer like a year ago, but also letting me know that I was on Amazon Prime and that I was able to, you know, access it for free. It's worth, absolutely, to your point, worth the 90 minutes. I think it's an hour and a half or hour and 45, whatever it is.
It's pretty quick doc, to be honest.
No. It's very, very worth, very much worth watching. So,
one of my favorite movies of the year by far.
Definitely. I was hoping that we were going to do a pod towards the end of the year or in the first part of next year where we could talk about 2017 documentaries. I mean, we may still do that. And we'll certainly revisit this film, City of Ghosts, and reference that. And there's a couple other docs that I saw this year that I think that definitely bear mentioning. So those are our recommendation: Brigsby Bear and City of Ghosts. Don't maybe watch them.
Which would you? I was gonna say which. If you had to choose, which one are you watching first, and which one are you watching second?
Watch City of Ghosts first.
Yeah, and then cleanse the palate with
and then
Brigsby
watch Brigsby Bear.
I'd
it's
say.
Gonna be a little bit more lighthearted fare. It's gonna be a little more lighthearted. But anyway, that's the gist of what I wanted to go over. Did you have anything else?
No, that was it. I would say keep an eye out for the rest of the year. We have the Disaster Artist coming out next month.
Yes. Oh,
that's probably the one that I'm looking forward to the
most. That's right. So you're looking forward to the Disaster Artist. Of course, I'm looking forward to The Last Jedi. I want to get a pod out as soon as possible in The Last Jedi. I will be in Japan at the time. We're going to have to arrange for a time to record. Who knows how good my hotel Wi-Fi is going to be. Or hostel or pod or whatever, wherever I'm sleeping.
Sure. McDonald's, Starbucks. Yeah. They have Starbucks in Japan?
Yeah, I'm sure there are. So we'll see about that. Also, we are going to be doing an episode here shortly on Coco, the new Pixar film that came out this weekend. I did see it. You haven't seen it yet, Aaron.
No.
Do I need to convince you?
I'm probably
going to
watch it. I have very little interest in it, but it's because it's a cartoon. So I'm not a big cartoon fan. But the subject matter is really interesting to me.
Okay. So. And why is that?
We'll see. Well, I mean,
takes place in Mexico.
So
I read an article on theringer.com from Shay Serrano about how nervous he was when this film was coming out because Pixar was tackling, you know, Latino culture. And he was nervous about them botching it, and his review was glowing about how they didn't. I'm going to tell you right now, I loved the movie, despite the fact that it has a 20-minute Disney animation short before it about Olaf.
Wow.
So just be prepared for that. You're going to get a Frozen adventure that has like 5 songs in it, and it is long. If you can get past
Crazy.
That, Coco itself is everything that we love about Pixar.
So do we know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mexican culture, but part of the Mexican culture is we show up late to many, many events. So do you think that they put in this 20 minute short because they knew Mexican people were going to show up late to the movie?
That may have been by design.
Okay. But, all right. Nice one, Pixar.
Again, I don't want to spoil our pod because I'm waiting for you to see it. I know Skylar saw it, and he's still upset about the Frozen short beforehand. He's so upset that he's not even willing to talk about whether he liked or didn't like Coco. But I'm going to tell you right now, Coco is so vibrant and colorful and imaginative and one of the most creative pieces of cinema I've seen in a long, long time. Not to mention a killer final act that had my crowd clapping at the end of the film. Like a loud clap. This isn't just like the, you know, sometimes you see a film that's got, you know, the fanboys and girls that some will clap at the end. No, the theater was, majority of the theaters clapped at the credits because it just absolutely nails the end. And it's really heartwarming and incredibly inspiring story. And just like what Pixar does, they tell a story that has heart. Seriously, Coco was really good. I can't wait to review it in
full.
Very
cool. So. All right, I think you might have sold me, and I guess I'm gonna have to go check it out.
Yeah, and I'm not even Latino. But they really
well,
do.
You were for one
you
night.
You can tell. I mean, it's steeped in culture. Like it's very much. You could tell they went to great lengths to make sure, and it's including a co-director that was a first time director for Pixar, which they don't. You know, they rarely do. Who is Latino, and so you know, obviously they wanted to make sure that this wasn't, you know, a group of white people trying their best, which unfortunately is often the case in Hollywood. So seriously, the movie is very, very good. You got to check it out. So,
all right, we'll do.
All right. Well, that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Go see Brigsby Bear, go see City of Ghosts, and go see Coco because we will be reviewing it shortly. But that's it. As we sign off, like we normally do, with our favorite line from Jurassic Park, I speak for all of us when I say that. As we say, hold on to your butts.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.